WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Recently released Nixon White House tapes offer a more detailed picture than we've ever had of Nixon's involvement in Watergate. Now the tapes have been transcribed and edited by historian Stanley Cutler for his book Abuse of Power. Cutler says these new tapes provide a massive, overwhelming record of Nixon's involvement in and his instigation of obstruction of justice and abuse of power. They expose a level of culpability far greater than imagined 25 years ago. The first Nixon tapes, about 40 hours worth, were released in April of 1974. Nixon resigned soon after, in August. Nixon tried to prevent the release of the remaining tapes, but over 200 more hours detailing his abuse of power have been released as a result of a lawsuit against the National Archives and the Nixon estate, filed by Cutler and the group Public Citizen. The tapes still can't leave the archives, so we can't play them on the radio. The tapes begin shortly after the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, The Secret History of the War in Vietnam. The recordings detail how Nixon tried to destroy Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the papers. The group of former CIA agents known as the Plumbers broke into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist looking for incriminating information. The Plumbers were later caught breaking into the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate, leading to a massive cover-up, which the tapes document. One of the big questions about Watergate is, why did Nixon try to cover it up instead of letting other people take the fall?
I think I've got another dimension to it. The standard answer that I and others have often given for the institution of a cover-up is because there was a need to protect the president from any revelation of the so-called White House horrors of the first term. That is, the existence of the Plumbers, which engaged in illegal break-ins, and the Houston plan, which also authorized illegal break-ins, the IRS abuses, the enemies list, and so forth. Those are the standard reasons given for the cover-up. But here in these new tapes, Nixon on two occasions, one's when he's talking about the Plumbers' break-in of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, and a second when he's talking about the authorization of illegal break-ins under the so-called Houston plan. He says, "I cannot admit that the President of the United States authorized illegal acts." It was a kind of psychological moment. Here was the man who for 25 years had championed himself as the advocate of law and order. The man of high-toned moral principles is now going to go out and admit that he authorized second-story men to engage in illegal break-ins for his administration. It was really more that he could bear to face. Ironically, I would argue that had he said this, his supporters would have still supported him, and he might still have gotten away with it. But he found himself that he couldn't bring himself to say those things because they such an admission clashed so violently with the self-image he had projected and nurtured so carefully through the years.
You know, Nixon says in 1973, the cover-up is what hurts you,
yes.
Not the issue. It's the cover-up that hurts. So he seemed to, at the same time, order the cover-up and be aware that a cover-up is a really dangerous thing.
It was incredibly perceptive of him. He realized that the cover-up was the truly dangerous thing that he was engaged in. And ironically, you find him talking quite often about the Alger Hiss case. And he says the thing that helped him, Nixon, the most of his case, was the perceived attempt on the part of the Truman administration to cover it up. They really weren't trying to cover it up, but this is the way he interpreted it. He understood the dangers of a cover-up. He understood it very, very much because he understood that it involved an obstruction of justice, which was a criminal matter.
Nixon had been engaged in discussing break-ins of a couple of other places, the Brookings Institution, the Washington, D.C.-based think tank, and the National Archives. What were the proposals there? What did... Well, Nixon, or in the case of the archives, Ehrlichman hoped to get?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were looking for secrets of past misdeeds of other administrations. But, you know, there are moments in these tapes, like talking about the break-in of the Brookings, talking about the break-in of the National Archives, talking about wanting everybody in a certain institution fired within 24 hours. This is the president venting his anger and his frustration. And he says, I want this done. I want this done now. And, of course, nobody did anything. There was no break-in at the Brookings. There was no break-in at the National Archives. I think that some of the newspaper stories that occurred shortly after the release of these tapes that made a great deal out of those things, they did them without any understanding of context, that this was just the president letting off steam. It's what went through his mind. There is no evidence that he ever acted on it, no evidence that any of his people followed up on this. And I just take it at face value as the venting of a little anger and a little steam.
Now, how do you interpret this? Nixon said, after the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, he said, mm-hmm. we're up against an enemy, a conspiracy. Right. They're using any means. We're going to use any means.
Right. Well, now there I take him very seriously. Nixon, as always, believed he was the victim of plots, of conspiracies, particularly when it came to the media, the establishment. They didn't like him, he believed. The fact is, throughout his presidency, throughout his career, he made great use of the media. In 1972, most of the media favored his reelection. But this is Nixon in what I always call his Uriah Heep mode, feeling put upon. He would indeed tell his aides, I don't want you to talk to the New York Times anymore, the Washington Post. And indeed, there would be some momentary expression of anger as to the last part of that quotation. We're going to do something about them. It's not clear that he ever did anything. And indeed, he continued to court those newspapers by all means.
What about Henry Kissinger? How does he come out looking in the tapes? I mean, Nixon thinks Kissinger is leaking to the press at some point.
So they have
a quarrel between them about that. But what was Kissinger in on, and what did he actively participate
well,
in?
Well, you know, there is an obvious tension between these two men. Nixon is very unhappy, you know, when Kissinger gets a Nobel Prize, why not me? After all, didn't Kissinger take his orders from Nixon? He would resent if Kissinger became Man of the Year on Time magazine cover. There was a rivalry there. Well, throughout these tapes, his reference to Kissinger asking for wiretaps of his key National Security Council aides to find out who's leaking to the media, and Kissinger is up to his ears in that, and Nixon keeps reminding him of it. There are conversations, though, that in the eyes of many people today don't serve Kissinger very well. He appears to be the ultimate toady, buttering up the president. There is a conversation on the night of April 30th after Nixon has fired Haldeman and Ehrlichman, his key aides, and Kissinger has his conversation with him and tells Nixon again how great he is and that Watergate doesn't mean anything. History's going to remember Nixon as the great man of peace and so forth. Yet in his own memoirs, at the same time, in his diary, which appears in his memoirs, Kissinger says for the night of April 30th that he knew that Nixon was dead in the water at that point, that the administration was paralyzed and probably on the way out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stanley Cutler, and he sued the National Archives for the release of the Nixon tapes. And those tapes have since been released. Stanley Cutler has edited them for his new book, Abuse of Power. I think one of the really interesting revelations from these tapes is how the Nixon White House tried to use government agencies for the Nixon White House's own, personal gain, wanted to use the CIA to thwart the FBI investigation of the Watergate break-in. Mm-hmm. But Nixon hated the CIA because the CIA gave a briefing to Kennedy on Cuba during the 1960 presidential campaign. Nixon wanted the IRS to go after journalists Daniel Schorr and Mary McGrory, but he wanted retribution against the IRS for going after his buddy Billy Graham. So it's just,
John Wayne.
Yeah, so it's just really interesting to read about how he was trying to manipulate these government agencies for his own gain.
You see this very clearly, or you hear this very clearly. He's a man of passions, of pique, of anger, of hurt. He nurses grievances constantly. You know, his old speechwriter and aide, the columnist William Sapphire, in the book that he wrote during the time, it's called Before the Fall. He talked about Nixon and some of his advisors like Colson and Haldeman sitting around rubbing sores. It's like they would like to fester. They had these festering conversations, and they'd say, get this guy, get that guy, and so forth. The tapes are filled with those sort of things. And as I say, it's a reflection of the man's anger and his pique and his anxieties.
It's interesting to read some of Nixon's anti-Semitic language in his tirades. He says to Haldeman, Bob, please get me the names of the Jews, you know, the big Jewish contributors of the Democrats. Could we please investigate some of the expletives? Then he criticized a reporter and FBI executive saying, they're both Jews, and that has nothing to do with it, but it at least gives you a feeling of the possible motivation deep down of the liberal leftists. Did you find this kind of anti-Semitic language recurring a lot in Nixon's
talk? It recurs a good deal throughout these tapes. The people who leak in government are Jews. McGovern has big Jewish contributors. Well, you know, Nixon did too. He kind of ignores that. Now, you know, on this subject, his defenders and his associates, some of whom are Jewish. But by the way, you know, one should point out that he did have an ample representation of Jews in the government, Henry Kissinger, Leonard Garment, White House aide, and so forth. And they want to point out that they'd like to point out that Nixon's anti-Semitism never became, quote, operational. Unquote. Well, I never know quite exactly what to make of that. What do they mean? That Nixon never ordered a Holocaust? He never ordered the elimination of people? The fact is that he used this language. It's used to express his anger, his frustration, his envy. It's not very becoming. And you know, I don't see why it's difficult for people to admit that. It simply is not very becoming. It's very unpleasant, and it recurs a great deal. There's not an isolated episode of it.
The last tape that Nixon made in the White House, the last tape that you've transcribed for your piece.
Well, I think it's the last tape that he made in the White House. The last recording we have. It's on July 12th. The day that Butterfield revealed the existence of the tapes.
So his final words, Nixon's final words in a conversation with Kissinger are, keep fighting. Mm-hmm. What's the context of that conversation and the significance of Nixon's words?
Well, it's a conversation with he and Kissinger often engage in these kind of mutual support conversations of each trying to buck up the spirits of the other. And the word, I find that conversation fascinating because the word fight runs through his memoirs like a red thread. Battle, conflict. He was a combative man. He saw life as a constant struggle, and a constant battle, and a constant fight. And I was struck by the fact that these are almost his last words in this last recorded conversation. Keep fighting. The fact is that the man, when you think about it, from May 73 on, Nixon realizes the consequences for him, that if any of this cover-up is ever revealed, uncovered, that he is in serious trouble, he will probably have to resign. Yet he fights desperately. On the night of April 30th, when he fires Haldeman and Ehrlichman, there are all these very depressed, distraught conversations he has. Yet you look at the conversations of May 1st, if you listen to them, and listening to them is very much different than the spoken word often. He's very full of fight, full of energy. He's determined to fight on. And the fact is that he kept fighting from the time this taping system closed down in July 73 almost until the day he resigned, and finally then he realized how hopeless it was. But the conversation between Kissinger and Nixon is really a kind of mutual support one.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stanley Cutler, and he's the editor of the newly released Nixon tapes, and he's edited those tapes for the new book, Abuse of Power, and he actually sued for the release of those tapes. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stanley Cutler, and he sued the National Archives for the release of the Nixon tapes. He's since gotten their release. He's edited them, and those edited transcripts appear in his new book, Abuse of Power. Now, it's interesting, you know, when Johnson recorded a lot of his conversations, of course, those Johnson tapes have been released and edited for a new book as well. Mm-hmm. And as that book and your book makes clear, one of the first things Nixon did when he got into the White House was disassemble the LBJ recording system. But then, shortly thereafter, Nixon created a new recording system that was slightly different than the Johnson system. What insights do you have about why Nixon disassembled the recording system and then set it up again?
Well, we have no certain knowledge as to why he did. By the way, a two-year period of time elapsed before he and Haldeman instituted the new system. I just don't know why he did it. I like to suggest that he dismantled it because Johnson assembled it, and he was determined to do things quite differently than Johnson. Why does he reassemble it, though? Why does he institute it? And I think that the answer lies in his sense of history and his desire to preserve his version of his history of his administration. And, you know, in his memoirs, he tells us why he didn't want to burn the tapes, to destroy the tapes. And I see no reason why we shouldn't take him at face value. He says he didn't want to destroy those tapes because he wanted to have his version of history to use against others who would try to insist on theirs. It was a kind of I got you mentality. But why he ever dismantled Johnson's system is not clear.
Nixon's recording system was a little bit different than LBJ's. LBJ's right. was button activated. He had to press a button and start recording. Nixon's system was voice activated, so as soon as he started talking, the system started recording.
Right.
Do you think that everybody in his office was aware that their conversation with Nixon were being recorded?
Well, Haldeman knew because Haldeman helped install the system. People such as Kissinger, Ehrlichman did not know at first. I think over time they sense this. There are times when, for example, I think there's some strong evidence that Ehrlichman knew before he acknowledged knowing that the taping system existed. But with others who came in, they did not know. I think Haig knew from the outset. But these are indeed, as you said, a voice activated. I think at times it's very clear to me that there are some contrived conversations, particularly between Nixon and Haldeman, where they're talking for the record. Oh, I didn't know this. I don't know that. They're talking about deep black holes, you know, which is a kind of, it turns out to be a code for the plumbers. You know, sometimes you have a tape recorder going, and sometimes you then become oblivious to it too, and you just talk.
You spent, I believe, about 5 years suing the National Archives with the group Public Citizen for the release of the Nixon tapes. Why did this become such, I would imagine, an obsessive mission for you?
No. I don't think it was. It was a question. Well, first of all, in 1987, the National Archives had finished processing the tapes and said that they were prepared to release them, and nothing happened. And I inquired, and they said, well, we're reviewing them again. When I say that they had prepared them for release, that meant that they had vetted everything for national security, for personal matters, family matters, and so forth. Well, I soon found out that Nixon was pressing for them to have a complete re-review of the whole thing, which would probably mean another 10 years. Well, finally, after numerous requests in 1992, after 5 years, we filed suit. We filed suit against the National Archives, and Richard Nixon joined the suit as intervenor. And the archives at first denied the existence of any more abuse of power or Watergate tapes. Ultimately, I was able to prove that there were substantially more tapes by simply going through Haldeman and Ehrlichman's notes and noting all the conversations that they're having with the president about Watergate. And I estimated that there was anywhere between 100 and 300 more hours of tapes. Finally, the archives agreed that there were 201 more hours. But Nixon continued to fight, and I have no doubt that if Richard Nixon were alive today, we would not have these tapes, because he simply was determined that they would not see the light of day in his lifetime. When he died is when we had the settlement.
Well, Nixon was in the process of resurrecting his career and his image as the great international statesman.
That's right.
If these tapes were released in his lifetime, how would you guess they would have affected his image reversal?
Well, it would have just brought back into sharp focus, and for generations of people who had no knowledge of Watergate or had not lived through it, it would have just revived all the images of the president doing wrong again. And he just did not want to face this in his lifetime. He had worked for 20 years in what I call his campaign for history, what Daniel Schorr has called his campaign to be elder statesman. And he had carefully nurtured this new image, and he did not want to see it dissipated.
Now, were the Nixon tapes released to you, do you have a special responsibility for those tapes?
No. When I won the suit, I have no special access. I suppose I was allowed to cross the threshold before everybody else. No, the day I went in to hear them was the day you or anyone else could go in to hear them. No, people misunderstand this, that when you get access to government documents, like under Freedom of Information, that you have some sort of privileged status. No, anybody else can come in with you that day.
Stanley Cutler edited the new book, Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes. We'll talk more on the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with historian Stanley Cutler, who has transcribed and edited over 200 hours of recently released Nixon White House tapes, detailing Nixon's abuse of power in the White House. Cutler's new book is called Abuse of Power. Nixon tried to prevent the tapes from being released, but the National Archives was forced to release them after a lawsuit filed by Cutler and the group Public Citizen. Tell me what it was like the first time you actually sat down after this long lawsuit and actually listened to one of these withheld tapes.
Well, it's different. It is. I mean, you know, you're hearing the president at a moment where he may be aware of the taping system, may not be aware of it, and you begin to realize that you're hearing an extraordinary amount of candor, personal input into affairs and the conduct of the presidency that we just have never had before. I mean, these tape conversations, whether even those that are somewhat contrived or that they're a president pushes the button, I mean, this is a whole new world for historians in terms of a new insight into the presidency. There is nothing like them.
Listening to these tapes, you actually got to hear the tone of voice that Nixon and the other involved parties used when speaking. I'm wondering if you think you got any new insights by actually hearing these conversations.
Yeah, well, I got not so much new insights, but a kind of new perspective on the man. I mean, you hear him in all of his modes at this time. He's distraught. He's emotional. He's depressed. He's anxious. He's exhilarated. He's determined. He's manipulative. You see him in a dominant mode. You see him at times, or you hear him at times. He's very passive. Whichever of these things, or all of the above, the man provides the whole gamut of human emotions. And that's interesting to hear the tone of his voice. You know, you get a much better sense, clearly, of when he's being sarcastic, for example, than if you're just looking at the cold written word. If you listen to his conversations of the night of April 30th when he fires Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Reading them at first, I thought, wow, this man is really exhilarated. The adrenaline is flowing after he's appeared on television and so forth. Oh no, you listen to it, you hear how distraught he was, how emotional he was, how depressed he sounded. He's speaking very slowly, emphasizing almost every word. He is slurring his words at times.
And what is he saying there?
Well, he says to Haldeman things like, I love you. I love you like a brother. Well, this is very uncharacteristic of Richard Nixon. We don't think of Richard Nixon in those terms. He's not a man who expressed the love or his feelings for people so openly. It was quite an interesting moment to read those, but then it was more interesting to hear those things. It just enhanced my own personal perspective on the man.
It seems to me, and I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, that there's this deep interest now in Nixon and Kennedy and Johnson. There's books coming out about all those presidents. Obviously, a lot of interest now in President Clinton's personal and public life. And I'm wondering if you think we're going through a period where presidents are almost being treated like celebrities in the public eye. I don't mean in terms of...
Well, they are. I mean, but that's nothing new. Mm-hmm. These tapes of all three of these men constantly raise the question of the relationship of the public to the private life. Certainly, there's a leak, a link in this in terms of the way a president is and behaves privately will in large measure determine the nature of public controversies before him. How much we should make of that, it's a little difficult to say. I don't know. I think you more or less have to take the evidence as it comes along. And here we have Nixon talking very candidly about affairs, and I think that we have to take those things at face value.
I'm wondering how President Clinton's campaign finance problems compare with what you've just gone through with the Nixon tapes. Mm-hmm. After examining Nixon, how do the questions about Clinton's campaign finances look?
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it disturbing with the process of what I call the trivialization of Watergate. You know, reporters seem to have fallen in love with the suffix gate to describe any kind of potential scandal, Debategate, Koreagate, and so forth. All that only serves to trivialize Watergate, which I regard as a major, major problem and event in 20th century in American history, if you will. There was a good deal of talk in the media some months ago or weeks ago when these White House videos were released of these people who came to coffees or teas or lunches at the White House in exchange for providing money. And immediately there were comparisons drawn between these White House video tapes and the Nixon Watergate tapes. Well, if we can invoke Mark Twain here, it's like the difference between lightning and lightning bugs. Those White House videotapes, what do they show us? They show us people at a party. I mean, they're not there secretively. These are contributors. What else is new? People contribute money for access all the time. On its face, that showed nothing illegal. There's no conversation there saying, now let's use the CIA to thwart the FBI investigation. How can anyone draw any comparison between the two events?
Stanley Cutler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Historian Stanley Cutler edited the new book, Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes.